Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome back to Season 2 of the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of data, customer insight, data science, analytics, and AI. As I shared in the preview episode for this season, a new emphasis for these conversations is that we'll be digging a bit deeper into some of those all-important softer skills for data leaders. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Brian O'Neill. Now, Brian is the founder of Designing for Analytics, an independent consultancy that helps data leaders turn their data into valuable data products. Through his UX consulting, speaking, and design training, he's helped launch several enterprise software companies, Aptopia, DispatchMe, Akori, and has worked and helped a whole range of businesses, including Dell EMC, TripAdvisor, Fidelity, NetApp, and even the City of Los Angeles, to name a few. Brian also hosts the Experiencing Data podcast, so I'll have to be on my game, listeners, as a fellow podcast host here, and advises for MIT's Sandbox Innovation Fund. Plus, even more excitingly, he leads a double life as a professional percussionist, where he's played with The Who and Donna Summer, so perhaps even more important people than us. An exciting and unique guest to have on our show. Welcome, Brian.
Great to be here.
Great to have you with us too. I'm really looking forward to exploring such a unique combination of talents and experience. You are really an interesting person.
Thank you.
You're welcome. With all my guests, Brian, I like to ask them at the beginning to give us an insight into their background, their career story, if you like, where they're coming from, what they can draw on to share the experience and advice they do. So in time-honored fashion, I'll do the same. Could you share with us something of your career journey, how a musician like you got into this line of work?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, huh? Well, thanks for having me on here. I don't want to bore your audience too much with my backstory, but I do have a degree in music performance, specifically in percussion studies. So basically, I get paid to play the triangle sometimes, or drum set, or whatever else it may be. So that's my formal training. And at the time when I was in school, this was early internet era. Web browsers were just coming out, and I got interested in web design. The bassoonist in the dorm room next to me was really starting to poke around with that, and was showing me, you know, just kind of how the internet worked. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I want to build a web page for the drum line, because I was captain of the drum line. And so I started tooling around on the side between rehearsals and concerts and all my studies doing that. And long story short, ended up interning at a marketing agency that was doing early website development, mostly for tourism in Northern Arizona. So think like Grand Canyon and Sedona and all this region. So I basically taught myself Photoshop, and you know, there was a developer there, so I was learning a little bit of Cold Fusion and doing HTML. And back in those days, you kind of did full stack, you did everything. Yeah. And so by the time I graduated from music school, I had a few clients of my own and had been, you know, working there during the summers and things like that. So I kind of had these two skill sets, and I didn't even really realize how much I had learned there. And this is like 1999. That I was able to get a job at a start when I moved to Boston. I live in Cambridge, Cambridge, Massachusetts, these days.
The impersonator of the real Cambridge, go on.
Exactly. So I don't know why it's not called New Cambridge, because we have New York and all these other new ones, exactly. But it's not good. New Cambridge. So, but I was when I moved out here to, you know, focus on my career and stuff, I was like, oh, I want to be a musician, but I need to get a job. So maybe I can get a job doing web design. Well, this is 1999. And I mean, there were so many jobs available. And if you could like say the words, you could probably get a job doing it. Yes. And I actually had a pretty decent portfolio for, you know, my age and just what I had done. And so I got hired by a startup, if you remember ZDNet and CNET back in the day.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, that started my career on the design side of things. And as I moved through both of these careers, by 2006, I was, you know, director of design at a startup called eons.com, but I was really like the two career balance was getting difficult. So I decided to go independent in 2006 and I've been self-employed ever since. But my clients and stuff have ranged primarily as I moved through my career, they got more and more into the information space.
Yeah.
So I worked a lot in financial services, so JP Morgan Chase and Fidelity. Right. And when I worked at Lycos, which was used to be a content site and search engine competitor to Yahoo back in the early 2000s, I worked on all the financial verticals that they had. So then I got into investing and designing early streaming charting applications for day traders and stuff. And so that was kind of the start at like getting into analytics. And through kind of that financial services work I was doing, I got pulled into this very niche area, which is a software to run data centers. And we have a bunch of those companies out here in the suburbs of Boston, HP, NetApp, Dell, EMC, particularly in the storage area, but also networking, storage, servers, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had a client of mine that had kind of every time he jumped jobs, he would call me and say, Brian, we need design help. This product is unbelievably complicated. It's way too hard to sell. And it was all analytics. And it was all a lot of that work was dealing with the telemetry of data in the data center to help keep those things, keep businesses running, basically. And I always thought of it as like oxygen. Like you just kind of take for granted the internet works, the email works, applications just run all the time. Just you just kind of expect uptime. You don't even think about it anymore. But you know, especially when things were a little bit pre-cloud and people had a lot of on-prem, there was a lot of stuff to maintain. So I worked a lot on consulting in that domain for maybe 10 years or something like that. And so that's kind of when I started to intentionally focus on analytics and data science, because I had worked on other startups and smaller companies out here that were also building decision support applications like Aptopia. They do, they're like a mobile data company. So if you're a mobile publisher, they provide information on how do apps make revenue in all the app stores? What SDKs are they using?
Yeah.
How are they monetizing those things? So I kept kind of like following along in these kind of data, what I call broadly data products in this space. So that was, I just decided in 2006 to really intentionally focus on this instead of kind of just being a contract product designer to really focus on analytics. And that's actually the first time when I actually learned that there was internal data science and analytics teams that were not building commercial software, but rather they were building internal data products, dashboarding, decision support, reporting, all this kind of stuff. I had never worked with any of those sides of the business because I was always working on the product, that usually the software product, or at the banks, it was always the interfaces for the customers to use. And so like, I remember just being super green and going to the first time I spoke at the Strata, O'Reilly Strata conference, and going there, and it was like fish out of water because most of the people there were all from this internal data side of the house. And I was like, wow, like this analytics thing is quite large. It's not just software companies, you know, the few software, you know, SaaS companies that are selling it, or you know, the hardware companies I've been working at. So that's really when I learned there was this whole other audience. And then I realized that one of the primary challenges in that space was low adoption. Yeah. So people aren't using a lot of the solutions that were being made by this team and a lot of by these teams. And a lot of the challenge wasn't in the building of the technology, but rather in the human factors pieces. And I was like, wait a second, we've known how to do this in software for 20 years now. Like, design and user experience are critical if you want to get adoption and even stay alive as a software company. Why are these internal data teams not building their data products the way, quote, we do? I still kind of more associate with the software industry,
yes.
why don't they do it the way we do it? It's just a lot easier and it has better results. And it's not obvious to people. No. And that's what I've learned. And so my mission has kind of been, as I say it, the enemy that I'm fighting against with my mission is really this low adoption problem. Cause I don't think people today want to work on stuff that doesn't ship, that doesn't have impact, especially leaders. They want to leave a mark. And just building another giant customer data platform, it sounds like you're doing all this work and you're writing all this code and you're building all these pipelines. But if you can't show anything for it, no one cares. Nobody uses it. It's not having impact. I think there's fewer people out there now that feel satisfied with like, well, I wrote code this week. I did my job. Someone else's problem. I think that's changed a lot, especially with COVID and with remote work. You could work anywhere now. Wouldn't you rather work a place where your work is going to ship and it's going to have impact? So I'm trying to help people with my audience with that these days, particularly. Again, in the data product space, how do we apply product management and user experience design practices to building analytics and machine learning solutions so they get used? Because you can't get the business value if you don't have usage. So solve the usage problem.
completely agree, Brian. It's only really struck me as you talk through that, how complementary our kind of focus is. I focus on the coaching and mentoring of leaders, the training of the softer skills needed. And often that, even if I wouldn't narrow it down to that, the adoption issue, it is facing into how the leaders of data science teams influence a wider organization, drive impact, get the best out of their people, and be perceived as making a difference in the organization, which needs so much more than just their technical expertise through which they've kind of grown up through the ranks, so to speak. So I do see a quite similar ethos and drive to what you're experiencing.
Yes. Maybe we're on a little bit of the same mission.
yeah, maybe so. The other thing that struck me, actually, and it's interesting hearing you articulate it that way, is maybe your bringing of that UX and design thinking expertise is kind of a natural evolution to the focus there've been in recent years on data visualization in the analytics space. Because unlike you, my background has been largely exclusively those in-house data and analytics and data science teams. And I'd say that a journey for a lot of them over the last decade really has been to improve the quality of their static or interactive data visualization. So when they're just communicating what they've found or information to inform decisions, that aspect's much better. But of course, you're right. A lot of them have matured to the level where it's not just a visualization of the data they're providing. They're wanting to deliver data products that people in the wider organization actually use. So I suppose, if I understand right, that's like a build almost on the importance of data visualization going on to now the UX, the experience of using the product.
Yeah, so data visualization is one part. We in the design field, we would call that user interface design, which has data viz is a kind of a subset of that. Sometimes you're visualizing data, but there's more to it than just the data viz part. But the experience is the user experience thing looks a little bit wider at that, and I tend to think of it as something that's happening over time because if you think about it in terms of jobs to be done or tasks and workflows that people have, you're not just experiencing a dashboard in isolation. You're doing work of some type, a job, a task. There's a start. There's usually an end to it. And designers, user experience professionals, are looking at that temporal aspect of it. Right. What are they doing once they get the dashboard? And then where do they go? What do they do next? Are they putting stuff in PowerPoint? Are they copying numbers into another application and then transacting something? What are they doing? And we're looking for, where's there friction in that process where we could provide insights or smooth it out or reduce what we call tool time instead of goal time? Where is there too much time being spent manipulating tools and reduce that friction so that that user gets the value that they're looking for, whatever that may be. So data viz is one part of it. It's the most visual part of design, but it's not the only part, but it's the most visual part.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. So I guess you remind me of the work of a whole load of customer experience professionals, for instance, who I know, and the work that will be built out of that Bain type thinking of jobs to be done and the mapping of customer journeys, and the consideration of mobile moments and other things where they might want to address certain touch points and needs within that longer journey. Is that right. More similar to the thinking?
Yeah. Let's put it this way. I don't think we need it. I don't think we needed the CX term. We can think about CX and UX as being the same thing. You can apply design and user experience to an audience that's internal. They're not paying money. They're not swiping their card and paying, you know, my Tableau license costs $39.99 a month to use it as an financial analyst inside the business, right? Yeah. But they could still be the customer of the analytics team, the CFO and his team. So we can still apply this thinking about what if we treated it as a product. And I have a very specific definition of what a data product is, but one of the key parts about it is that it has to be so good that someone would pay for it or exchange something of value to use it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the data community gets so wrapped up in this term data product about talking about the technical aspects of it and what the output is. What I'm talking about when I give my definition of data product is it's actually more about the verb of doing things the product-y way. It's more about applying a practice to how we build the solution and not so much worrying about, well, it's just a dashboard. Well, is that a data product or not? Or like, that's the wrong question to be asking. It's really, did we create an outcome that was so powerful and useful that this person was excited to use it, that they felt empowered, they felt like they had a competitive edge or whatever it is that they're looking for. That's more what the spirit of it is from a product, a true product mindset. I don't know if that's helpful, but
I think it is, Brian. Yeah. And I was going to clap, really. I would completely agree with the ethos because I recognize the pitfall that you're describing there, that there absolutely is and always has been, really, in the data analytics and data science space, a certain snobbery about more technical skills, more technical solutions. And I agree, you do see that kind of manifest in the, it's not a data product unless it's got elements of AI or ML built into it or some algorithmic complexity, or it needs to be written in R or Python to be considered a data product, or it has to be delivered through data mesh. I mean, as you say, they're looking at the wrong side of the problem. The issue is, does it help someone? Does it make a difference in its utilization?
Exactly. It's kind of what this gets into. Which game are you playing? Like, the people in my audience that are interested in like what I call this product-y approach to data products, they're focused on outcomes. How do I create a better outcome? And some of them are still wrapped up in outputs, but they're starting to realize that we shipped this thing, but it didn't get used. Like something is off here. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to help them see the difference between shipping an output versus shipping an outcome. Yeah. And what customers and users want, including internal customers and business sponsors, they want outcomes. They want results. They want change. Yeah. They want impact. They don't want the thing. They want the benefit that comes from the thing. So if you're so relentlessly focused on the thing, you might miss out what the benefit is that they're looking to get. So how do we get into what the benefit is? That's very much the space I'm trying to influence my audience and help them with that journey and transitioning this. And you talk about soft skills. It's like, I mean, I just had Kyle Winterbottom on my show and we're constantly joking because like, everybody wants to hire data product managers and we don't know where to get them and stuff. But by the way, how's your Python skills? It's like the data audience leadership we talked about who your audience is. And so if you're a data science and analytics leader out there listening, if your problems are mostly not technical, and I'm not talking about, I don't have enough resources to code fast enough, that is a delivery problem. But if the deliveries are not resulting in outcomes and you're just delivering outputs faster, but the outputs are generally have a low acceptance rate from your customers, you have a different problem. Mm. You have a problem with not delivering benefit. Mm. And part of delivering benefit is that there's different skills required to get adoption to happen. And so what are you hiring for? And this joke about how's your Python, the job descriptions that are getting written for roles like data product management continue to have all these technical skills. Yeah. And I think it's because those teams know how to screen for that.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to screen for product management skills, design thinking, creativity. How do people connect and have empathy? How do they do research and understand how to dig an unarticulated problem out of a customer who's saying, I need an AI solution. Mm. I need a ChatGPT like thing that will help my customer service team work faster through our backlog of calls. They've loaded in an assumption about what the solution is. And unfortunately, I think there's a fair number of data leaders that hear, I need an AI solution to that. And they're like gung ho. They're so ready to start, you know, generating this giant machine learning based solution because that's what the customer ordered. And I'm like, this is not where you're not running a data drive through. You're not, you know, do you want fries with that dashboard? No, that's not what we're doing here. Yeah. So if you want to get better at this, you need to develop other skills or hire people with those skills or hire help. If you're having human adoption problems, more Python, more technical Jupyter notebooks, whatever, Spark, Apache, Cloud, Snowflake, Data Mesh, whatever, you're not going to solve it with all this more technical investment is not going to fix those problems.
Yeah, completely agree. Completely agree. And well done. You've connected up to the theme for series two, picking the brains of experienced leaders like yourselves on the importance of softer skills, not the technical side so much. So we've kind of begun slaying a bit of technical dragons there, I guess. But if I put on my contrarian hat, I guess I'd be hearing a lot of what you've talked about as just different types of technical skills in design, technical skills in UX, technical skills in product management. Shine a light for me a bit, Brian. Where are the softer skills that you've seen are really critical to doing what you're seeking to do and doing it well?
So candidly, I really don't like this term soft skills. It sounds like it's not, it has no meat to it. Okay. But in reality, when you think about even distributed teams now, the importance of being able to connect with other people to get shit done, like this is real skills. You can't not have these things because we're not a bunch of robots. So
what's your preferred term out of interest? Because I get that a lot. I simply use the term because of its common parlance. But what's your preferred term for them?
I've heard I think Seth Godin calls them real skills. And, you know, it's not the catchiest term in the world. But the point is, I think it's having a complete set of skills to work with other people. If you're not employed in a job where you literally work in isolation, you're self-employed, you do everything yourself. I mean, even then it's like, well, don't you have customers if you're self-employed? You can't not have these skills and work. So it's really a matter of where you are in that continuum and how you want to define them. But and you're right. I think there are a lot of designers that are focused on the craft of design and the technical aspect of the craft that don't necessarily want to get into what most user experience professionals and researchers do, which is mostly facilitating cross-functional teams to arrive at solution ideas, but also to get into problem discovery, particularly in user experience research. We're doing the research to understand where the friction is, where the opportunities are, what are people's attitudes and feelings about the solutions that they're using. We want to uncover those problems because if we can define the problem really clearly, usually the solution is a lot easier to get to. So that the problem with the solutioning is usually that it's solving for the wrong problem or it's not solving any problem. And so being an example of a quote soft skill to me is understanding whether or not you're solving what's called the presenting problem. And this isn't my term. I forget who's talked about this versus the underlying or the unarticulated need that's behind that. So being able to ask the right questions to dig into that, there's, you know, terms called laddering, for example, to do that and asking, you know, you've heard about five whys in some of this. Absolutely. Oh, there's some issues with, there's some problems with some of those methods. But the point of them, though, is that we're actually trying to get to some underlying need, such that then we can work backwards from that true need, which is what design does. We look at the endpoint first. We don't start with the data and work forward, but we work backwards from what might be amazing for this person. And we try to work that back to something that's realistic. And this is where product management gets in. It's got to be feasible and it's got to be desirable. And it's got to be something you can do quickly enough and technically feasible, et cetera, et cetera. But being able to do that kind of work is a great example, I think. Additionally, it's like, how do you convince a stakeholder that you're building something for that they're part of the solution? So one of the challenges that, you know, my audience has, and like some of my seminar clients have had, is that they're two or sometimes three hops away from the end users who are going to use the results of their work.
Yeah.
And there's middle teams that are saying, we don't have time for that. I just need these numbers on this dashboard, or I just need a chart that compares X and Y. There's no context for why it's needed. Nobody understands how it's used. And there's a defensive blocking going on there because my sales team needs to be on the phone. They don't have time to talk to you. Yeah. So how do you navigate through that and help them understand that to do this successfully, we don't want to give you something that's completely worthless. And by the way, here's 15 projects where we did it that way. And they're in the dashboard desert. Do you want to see our desert and what's in there? It's over here.
Yeah.
We don't want to add anything else to the desert, including your project and your money. So in order for us to do this, we need to design it with you. We can't design it for you. So you are part of the solution and we're going to do it together. And it doesn't mean you need to stand by me why my team writes the code. That's not what I'm talking about. But we professional product designers, we are constantly focused on customer exposure, both in the learning and the problem definition phase, but also in having design partners, which are customers that are, quote, friendlies that will check in. And when we send over something low fidelity, they'll give us quick feedback on it. So we don't go off in some wrong direction for 6 months building a giant thing and then realizing, wait, that we don't even have that problem anymore. Like that's gone, like COVID-19. That's a year ago. Yeah. Sorry guys, you're a little late here, but like we had to make a decision. It's too late. Like, so anyhow, those are some examples of just where soft skills begin to apply here. And they have nothing to do with writing code or your technical stack or your data platform or any of this. In fact, I cringe when I hear these giant projects to build data platforms. And there's most of the time when I ask people what are the success metrics for this thing, but not the technical success metrics, but how will you know if you did a good job when this goes live? Like what are the endpoints look like for the people who are supposed to get value from it? How would you measure that? What are the, you might call it use cases. What are the use cases for this? And are we checking along the way that as we build the platform, these use cases will actually be executable by the time the platform comes out? Or is it just a theoretical idea about how the data should be put into the warehouse or whatever the heck it is and architected and have all these policies against it? And it's like, that's nice. That's all defensive work, though. That's not helping the business do its job of making better decisions. So on the offensive, if we call that the offensive side, like, how would you know if it's doing a good job? What are the use cases? And most of the time, I can't get any. You get very broad answers like, well, we need to be able to have self-service dashboards. And I'm like, that's an output, but what are they trying to do? Like, what should they be able to build with this dashboard? Like, what are examples of that? And they can't. Everything's been abstracted and abstracted to the point where it's just, it all sounds like kind of mush. And yeah, sure, you can build a dashboard. Does that mean you're going to use it to make a decision? Not necessarily. You can actually shoot yourself in the foot with a dashboarding tool if you don't know what you're doing, or if you don't know what the data means. You think you're looking at customer data, but there's 52 different customer statuses in this dropdown, and you're like, I just want to know how many active customers we have. And it's like, you think you're looking at one thing and you're not, right? Because no one took the time to actually design that experience and understand when a finance person says customer, what they mean is this. And we need to make sure their experience allows them to see the world of our data that way. Anyhow, I'm rat-holing into into use cases and
into
stuff.
A lot. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense, Brian. And I'm with you on a lot of that. And I mean, as someone who lived through the first AI winter, I'm very keen that data science and AI teams and analytics teams genuinely prove their value. So we're not just living in a brief period of excitement and it goes away again. But I'd like to help hone you down a bit more. I guess you've touched on a lot of useful stuff there, Brian, genuinely, and thank you for bringing the examples to life. But I've already had guests on this series who've shared about the importance of listening, for instance, as one of these real skills, or in the last episode, translation, and how important translation is between technical and business organization speak, if you like. I guess when I listen to what you said in the individual softer skills, I'd notice things like empathy, really effective questioning to get to the underlying need, curiosity and joining the dots in a wider context and experience. Can I ask you to be more specific and maybe just pick one of those real skills that has really helped you?
One of the skills that's helped me personally, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, helped you be effective in helping others, you know, helped you be successful in your career, helped you make big differences for your clients, that benchmark.
Sure. I'd say, you know, one of the big ones for me is, when I think about like a client that I'm working with, I'm not just focused on delivering whatever the service is, whether it's consulting or whether it's speaking or whether it's mm-hmm. training, which are kind of the main things that I do.
Yeah.
I'm always asking that person on the other end of the call, what do you want to be true when we're done? Like if I'm giving a keynote,
yeah,
what do you want your employees to be saying in the room after we're done? Or what's not just the message they want to hear, but how do you want them to feel? And what's their current state right now? I want to understand the transformation that they either want for themselves or for their business or whatever. But I always get into not just the business, but also their personal interest, like what's in it for them. Like, yes, I can help you and your team get better at this, but what are you trying to do? I want to make sure that I'm aware that, like, oh, well, I'm going up for, I want to have a CDO title in my next job, and I need to be able to quantify the value of what we're doing here. And my team is not good at being able to do that. Yeah. So if I can get the skills to quantify the value of the solutions we're doing, that can go in my resume, and it's much easier for me to go up for a big title change if I can actually quantify some of this stuff. Oh, okay. So yeah, you want training for your team, but ultimately what you really want is that ability to quantify your impact. And, you know, adoption matters to even get there. You first have to have the adoption piece, but now I'm aware that this person's actually trying to track value. So he's buying training for his team, for example, on, you know, my thing is called designing human-centered data products.
Yeah.
But he or she personally is looking for eventually a career, a career jump or something like this. Mm. And their particular need is in that the defining of value and how we do that. So I selfishly, I'm looking, it's basically empathy, what you talked about, right?
Yeah.
It's really understanding at a human level, like what's in it for them. And this is something that I spent a lot of time on my podcast, and I just launched a data product leadership community as well just a couple of days ago. And this idea of really getting to know the actual end users of the service, and what is it like to be the CMO or the VP of advertising for the business or whatever? What is it like to be them? What is what do they hate about their job? What do they love about their job? The more you can tap into that, the easier it will be to design solutions that slide into their natural way of doing things, and they're going to be more likely to use them, but you're going to make an impact on that one person. That buys karma for the team, and that starts the transition from, like, we're a services team, we're a cost center in the business, to the data science team is like this, like this secret weapon partner that we have.
And
not only do they answer my needs, but when the data team comes to them and says, we've been playing around with this model that we think can predict X, you didn't ask us for this, but would you spend some time talking? We think we could predict this. Would that be useful to you?
Yeah.
now you're becoming an innovation center, and they're actually going to pay attention to you because you've had some wins on the board, because you care down at a very individual level about some very specific real people with real names, not the whatever department, but John and Jane in the marketing department. You know who they are. You know what it's like to be them. You know what they're struggling with. You've got some wins on the board. They're not going to do that end run where they go hire an outside firm to build their dashboards or whatever, because the data team is, quote, too slow and I don't get what I need back. And they just throw it over the wall and it's not quite what I need and blah, blah, blah. Now you're building a partnership there, but it comes down to individual human being, like getting to know them and what it's like to be them. So you can figure out how to make stuff for them that matters.
That's good. I like that, Brian, and the specificity of this is about interest in the individual and helping the individual, not just the kind of presenting problem or even the deeper business need. I wonder, have you got a story where your interest in the individual, you're discovering what was in it for them, caused you to go a different way in terms of what you delivered or do something very different than just your understanding of the underlying business need, if you like?
I'm sure it has. Here's an example. So I worked with a new startup in the investment banking space, and they're doing some stuff with natural language processing and building a tool basically for institutional traders. And on the surface, the 15-year-old, the younger version of me from 10 or 15 years ago would have said, oh, you need to design this application. It's for traders. Okay. Like, I can come in and redesign what you have. And I can see all the little low level design flaws right there. Clean up the screens, apply better graphic design, visual design principles, smooth out some of the UX, et cetera. What I didn't realize, what I realized today that's different from back then, which is like, what's your hourly rate and when can you start and blah, blah, blah. The outcome that this person wanted was, we actually sell this as an API, because the banks are going to want to build their own solution. What they want from us is the natural language processing, the machine learning that we've built to process, in this case, chat discussions between traders and their customers. That's what they want. But in order to sell that, I need to show them what's possible. So I really need a sales aid. And because ultimately my goal is, I'm actually trying to fundraise. So as I laddered up through this, I realized this person needs to close some sales and, you know, whatever the quarter was and whatever the dollar amount was, which we also discussed.
Yeah.
He ultimately needs to close some sales because he wants to raise an A round next season. In order to do that, or next season, but next year, in order to do that, he needs to show some traction on that. So we're not actually, and this may become a SaaS, or there may be customers that don't want to roll their own and they want to use the off the shelf SaaS version of the product, but that's not what we're doing right now. The win here is enabling sales to occur. So I didn't spend time designing out the entire product. There's aspects of the design which are more for a selling environment where the customer is not even touching the keyboard, but rather they're being presented to them. And there are things that I would not design if the actual end user was using the solution. I would not have designed them that way.
Yeah.
But I had to ask these questions because the buyers in this case, they don't express the need that way. They assume we have a design problem. This looks clunky and hard to use. I need someone to fix it and make it look nicer.
Yes.
That's what they presented to me, but they didn't tell me the reasons why and what they're going for. So we were cutting stuff left. It's like, you don't need that. Are you going to show that? No, great. Let's not work on that then. Let's get, you know, the A, B, and C use cases correct. Those are the high velocity ones. Let's make sure the data samples we're using really render out the possibilities with the with the analytics here that are going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we just relentlessly focused on that problem. And they walked away with a solution that they felt super confident going into sales calls with. They've got nothing but positive feedback so far. And I don't know how the sales have been going, but it's, you know, it's 12, 18 month sales cycles with the product that they're, you know, they're selling, et cetera. But it also, it gave them confidence and that's really what they were looking for. So you have to dig in, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I guess maybe to close then, Brian, I'd be interested, and this may be a bit of a tough question to just throw at you from nowhere, but have you discovered in situations like that where you've seen such a good return from being interested in individual and getting your head around what's in it for them, have you discovered a killer question? Is there a way that you tend to frame your questions that helps you get to that and uncover the kind of hidden aspect of their personal agenda or the opportunity to deliver more to their individual need better than any other? Do you have a killer question that works for you?
I've been a why questioner my whole life, and now I kind of joke I get paid to do that and to teach people how to ask it. I've actually learned some stuff about, I think it was Chris Voss's masterclass about why and how why can actually be a little bit nagging. If you imagine like your 4-year-old kid asking you why constantly, got to be careful with how you ask it. So sometimes I'll ask like, you know, what about this? Or, you know, what's the reason for X instead of Y? You get the same response and I change it. But the fundamental issue there is the why. And I'm constantly trying to ladder up until I get to some emotional reaction or something where it's like, oh, bam, there it is. That's the thing that wasn't stated here. Yes. Now I get the joke. I didn't get the joke until now, but now that I'm on, it's like our frequencies just like lined up, though you could see the sine waves and they just like clicked.
Yes.
Now we can go back down into the details, but I know what the journey is. I know why you're doing this and I know what you want to be true when we're done.
Yes.
And so a lot of this is I'm trying to teach that using the skills of design and consulting as well, and teach my audience of data product leaders how to do this stuff themselves and apply it to the machine learning and analytics space.
That makes good sense. I completely agree with you. I think if you do just use why as many times as you might want to, it can come across as a bit nagging. And that getting, I guess a psychologist would say, to the intrinsic value for the person, you know, what's the goal that is of actual intrinsic worth to them as a human being? You're right. It kind of illuminates everything else.
Yeah, indeed.
That's brilliant, Brian. Thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for all you've shared with us. It's been, as I thought it would be, fascinating to hear a different perspective, a different skill set being brought to this whole world. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Good to hear. And thank you everyone for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And there's also regular content on our blog at Customer Insight Leader. Or oneword.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains for me to say thanks to everyone again for your time. Have a great week. Perhaps you can give some thought to the perspective that Brian's brought to us. How much more effective could you be if your interest was in the human being, in the individual, not just the project, not just the challenge, not even maybe just seeing them as a stakeholder role, but them as a person? If you knew what was in it for them and you could let that guide your work, how could that help? Plenty to mull on. Bye for now.